are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 6, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist David Dayen on the attack on Wall Street reforms, the bipartisan attack on Wall Street reforms. Meanwhile, it's Tuesday. Is Texas going blue? At the very least, we're going to see who wins those Democratic primaries. Meanwhile, Sam Nunberg, his Kamikaze Monday. And South Korea says that North Korea open to nuke disarming. Paul Ryan splits with Trump on tariffs. Trump to fold. And Thad Cochran resigns. We're going to have two elections in Mississippi come November for the Senate. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn having to sell his house for legal bills.
Dead!
And British spies apparently had heard Russian Trump communications. And the center left, frankly, I guess the center right, big losers in Italy. And Oklahoma teachers may strike as West Virginia teachers are still out on the picket lines. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, just a bit of house cleaning or keeping. I believe Michael yesterday may have wished my sister happy birthday yesterday.
I did.
I also did. I didn't do it on the show, but I did in person. But now I need to make it official by doing it on the show. So happy birthday, Julie. I wish you many more birthdays.
But yesterday you were like, I'm not going to wish her a happy birthday. It's ridiculous.
That's what I said yesterday.
Stop forcing
and then
me.
I just said, all right, maybe I will.
It's going to take 80 hours.
We'll get there with Nunberg. Let me also just add, in the event that I forget tomorrow, I probably won't, but tomorrow is my son Saul's birthday.
I hope you don't forget that.
So let me just say happy birthday, Saul. And I mean, he's too young to listen to this anyways. He doesn't know. So at least I said I did it. I have it on record. I don't want to get in trouble.
A lot of Pisces in your family.
Is that right? March is?
Yeah, yeah. It's my birthday Friday, so I know these things.
There you go.
In a certain sense.
Okay. Right?
I thought you were like, let me do the Perry Mason. Or no.
All right, let me just give you an update on what's going on in West Virginia. Supposedly, there is a deal has been struck. It is a tentative agreement, 5% pay raise for all state workers in West Virginia. According to, and I'm getting this from the Jacobin feed, according to Jake Zuckerman, who's the political reporter of the West Virginia Gazette Mail, the West Virginia Senate Finance Chairman Craig Blair says any money for the raise would come from cuts to Medicaid and general services. So it is unclear whether or not that's the case. It's also unclear whether or not West Virginia teachers union leaders will accept that. It's also unclear whether or not the teachers, more importantly, will accept that. And I should also add that Oklahoma teachers, who are apparently the lowest paid in the nation, West Virginia, I think, comes in number two, maybe number three. I'm not sure. I can't remember off the top of my head. But they are citing the West Virginia strike. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And at one point, the reactionary forces are going to get a little nervous about this. And so at one point, we're going to see some attempt to really slow this roll. So just be ready for it. We will continue to update you in terms of Oklahoma. Meanwhile, and there's really not much to report on the South Koreans and the North Koreans in terms of the openness of North Korea to disarm or to denuclearize, I guess, the Korean Peninsula. But with that backdrop, speaking of somebody who got radioactive super quick. So yesterday on Katie Turr's program on MSNBC, which I think airs somewhere around like 2 p.m., maybe 1 p.m., I think it's the 1 o'clock hour. Sam Nunberg went on. Now, Nunberg's been around quite a bit. He was a, or is, a Roger Stone crony. In fact, he refers to Roger Stone as his surrogate father. And he has been on cable news quite a bit, getting a little bit more loosey-goosey with what he says. We actually played a clip of his the other day. And apparently he received a subpoena with a 3 o'clock deadline as of yesterday to deliver materials. And at some point over the weekend, he reacted to either what he had to hand over, the work involved in handing it over. Now, there is a search function in emails. I should tell you that right now. He had to hand over emails for certain people, but maybe he didn't know that. And it's also possible, quite frankly, based upon what happened during later in the day, he had some type of episode and a problem with his medication. I'm not mocking that. I mean, that happens to people and that's difficult. And maybe you don't necessarily have the ability to know you shouldn't go on television in that situation. And maybe you don't have people around you who have the ability to say, hey, you shouldn't go on television in that situation. But he did. Here he is calling in to Katie Turr's show. And this started basically an avalanche for the day. But here is that first exchange where Nunberg is basically saying, like, I don't need to answer to a federal subpoena for a grand jury. What's he going to do to me?
That's ridiculous. Last 24 hours or last
subpoena,
week where you've decided not to do this.
When I got that subpoena, it was ridiculous to me. The subpoena is absolutely ridiculous. Why should I hand them over every email I've had with Steve Bannon or Roger Stone since November? And you know what? Since November of 2015, give me a break.
Sam, what about those who might look at this and say you have something to hide, or there's something that you don't want to reveal because now you're saying you're not going to cooperate? What if people think it looks suspicious?
Let them think what they want. Let them think what they want. You know what? I'm the first person to go out here and say I'm not cooperating because it's absolutely ridiculous what they want from me. Katie, should I spend 80 hours going over emails that I've had with Steve Bannon and Roger Stone?
If you're going to defy a grand jury subpoena, Katie, are you worried about being held in contempt of court?
Let's see what Mr. Mueller does.
Are you worried about getting arrested?
I think it would be funny if they arrested me.
If you're held in contempt of court,
really funny if they wanted to arrest me because I don't want to spend 80 hours going over emails I had with Steve Bannon and Roger Stone.
Now, the charges, I don't know, that might be like the third line of the charges. The first line would be failure to comply with a federal subpoena, and that's why they would arrest him. I mean, it happens.
That would be funny.
And apparently, it'd be super funny.
What's really funny is that he sounds like my impression of you.
Yeah, it's true.
The other part is I can relate, though. I'd be like, can't you just have the NSA do it? It does sound like...
That is absolutely... Well, guys, ultimately... you already have been illegally obtaining all of our information anyways, whether it's through the corporate surveillance state or the state apparatus. Just get what
he
already have.
He ultimately said, like, I'd rather just give him my password and let them go in and find it.
Ooh, Sam, judging by my sense of who you might be as a person, I don't think that's a good idea, buddy.
I mean...
There's going to be so many crimes that are uncovered through this process that have nothing to do with the original purview.
Look, there seems to be basically no other news that exists except for this, like, full-day meltdown. Because he went, so that's, like, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So he went from that show to, like, Jake Tapper's show, right?
Yep, and Tapper. And then he also did one on, like, a local New York station.
Yes,
a name I don't...
Spectrum.
Yes, he went to Spectrum New York One News, and then okay. So look, just if you're not in New York or you don't know these, the physicality of these things, he's calling to Katie Turr, who is on 49th and 6th Avenue. Then apparently he goes to 8th Avenue, two blocks over, and 60th Street to the CNN studios. Then he goes to the Spectrum News Studios, which I believe might be in that same building because that is the Time Warner building. And then, and maybe he was on the phone, then he heads over to Ari Melber's by 6 o'clock in MSNBC. So he's back at 49th and 6th.
You send the car, I'll melt myself down in public.
And then he heads back to CNN for Aaron Burnett like an hour later. And I lose track of it at that point. But we should tell you a little bit of who Sam Nunberg is because people don't necessarily know. Just to give you, you know, to catch you up. Well, yeah, this is his origin story. Here is Sam Nunberg in his own words to how he came into the Trump orbit.
First time I met Donald Trump, I was 5 years old at WrestleMania 5.
Donald Trump invited the young Sam Nunberg right into the heart of the action.
I'll give Hogan a job in Hollywood. He can drive my limo.
We were sitting right behind Trump, and he had us move to the first row at another section. And it was actually funny because I ended up getting on the video for WrestleMania with my father. We were doing like the Bushwhacker.
Well, they've got a style all their own, Jess. You know, I know, Gorilla, I noticed you the other night walking through the casino looking like that.
Me?
Yeah.
Nunberg was with Trump when he tried the Bertha issue out for the first time.
I can't stop! I can't stop! So... Oh, God. It's like every day, it just gets more and more insane.
Like, we're definitely Rome, and we're collapsing, but was there... I keep asking this, like, were there specific moments inside Rome, like... Definitely they can match us for greed, cruelty, empire, but just sheer stupidity. It was spectacle we match, but like, was there this level? Like, was Romus Maximus like on a public square talking?
Think
like
of all
Sam
the viral moments in Rome that went unshared.
That's right.
Probably true.
That's right. It's just like
They threw him in with the lies. He ain't even a Christian, dude.
Little talk around the vomitorium, and it just doesn't go anywhere from there. Folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to David Dayan about a bill that is about, if it hasn't already, about to pass the Senate, a bipartisan bill that will really unwind a lot of the protections that were not necessarily robust to begin with of Dodd-Frank. We'll be right back in a moment. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. It is always a pleasure and an honor to welcome back to this program one of the most prolific and knowledgeable reporters and journalists, I think, in print today. And of course, I'm referring to David Dan, who has a piece. I mean, we could pick and choose. Really, literally, almost any day, you could pick and choose what piece you would want to talk to David Dayan about. So I have to like sort of stack him up a little bit. But David, you've been writing about Sam Nunberg for 24. No. You have been writing about a bill that is winding its way through the Senate now. And I see that the Washington Post has sort of, caught up a little bit on this. But the it is a bill that is going to unwind a lot of the key protections that Dodd-Frank, as anemic as it was in some respects, in terms of protecting our financial system. And this is stuff that is like, it's a little bit dry. I saw when you promoted this piece on Twitter, you were somewhat apologetic. And
I'm always apologetic because I always come bearing bad news.
Well, that's so true.
You know, I don't know if I need a theme music of the bad news. Dave Dan and the bad news. But this bill is supported by 13 members of the Democratic caucus, 12 Democrats and Angus King, who caucuses with them. And it's a bank deregulation bill. And it's being sold as a bill to give relief to community banks, the finest salt of the earth people in the world, community banks. Unfortunately, it also, in the process, gives numerous gifts to much larger banks, not only what I've come to term the stadium banks, which are banks not big enough to be Wall Street megabanks, but big enough to have a stadium named after them. But it also even goes up the chain to the Wall Street megabanks. Citigroup has a carve out in this bill, actually two. Banks like JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo will be able to take advantage of a number of protections. And in many ways, this bill gives the Federal Reserve, which is the number one bank regulator, fewer tools than they had even before Dodd-Frank, even before the financial crisis. They will be more constrained than they were at that time, and they didn't exactly perform wonderfully before the financial crisis.
Right. All right, so let's back up a little bit here so that people sure understand the stakes that are involved in this. Because I think, you know, in the context of our news cycles today, it is very easy for people's eyes to glaze over on this stuff. And I think that's why, as soon as you post something that you are apologizing for, I'm immediately like, we've got to book him on our show. Because this is why I think people come here, to have their eyes glaze over and to go a little bit numb. Right. But this is really important stuff. And I want to just for a moment put a pin in the story of those 13 Democrats or 12 Democrats and Angus King for a moment, because that's really important. But let's start with the original intent. Because this is really a story about how things go wrong, and the story of consequences of elections, frankly. Let's talk about S2155 when it was first proposed, and what its intent was.
Yeah. So the history is that we passed Dodd-Frank, which in 2010 provided a number of new rules to ensure safety and stability in the financial system. It was largely a series of technocratic tweaks, but it certainly advanced from the almost no regulation that we had on the banking industry prior. So in the process, almost immediately, community banks, which are banks that hold less than, these are the banks in your rural area or small banks in your in urban areas that, you know, they are they sponsor the football, local peewee football team, and they, you know, all the tellers because you went to high school with them. These are the small community banks and credit unions. And they have a very saintly reputation on Capitol Hill. And they said, hey, we're getting caught up in all these rules that you put on the financial system, on the big banks, the ones that really got us into trouble. And when we didn't do anything, and now we're paying the compliance cost, they have bigger staffs to handle this, the mega banks do. And this is a larger portion of our budgets, and it's making us hard to compete. Now, that narrative is actually not true, by the way. Community banks are doing fine. 96% of community banks are making profits. To the extent that there are consolidations in that system, it's a long-running issue of that has nothing to do with Dodd-Frank. The drops are right in line with the last 30 years. They have to do with population shifts and the rise of these giant supermarket banks that have taken over the country.
All right, now let me just stop you there too. In terms of the it is understandable on some level, and I hope people don't think I'm being an apologist for community banks, because I'm fully supported by them. No, but I'm. But they're, when you say they're saintly, it's because they're very local, right? And
right.
And from a politician's perspective, it's like the hometown
right.
bank. And regardless of what they do in terms of their practices, they can never be a threat to the financial system in a way that
can't be a threat to overall financial stability per se.
Right.
It's more that they're a major presence in every congressional district in every state. And so they get they have a lot of clout on Capitol Hill. And indeed, they have already enabled a lot of tailoring so that they aren't affected by Dodd-Frank rules. And that's already been done. However, they're asking for more. And Democrats and Republicans kind of agree with this for what it's for good or for ill. They believe that community banks need some relief. And so Democrats came to the table for years with a package of ways to exempt community banks and credit unions from these rules. They say this will, put them on a more level playing field so they can compete with larger banks in their communities.
So even though they're doing okay financially, and as someone who has been working so closely and examining the bank reforms for really the past decade, I think that you have been.
Mm-hmm.
That package, though maybe unnecessary, was not terribly problematic because of these banks' relationship to the broader financial system.
I mean, put it this way. You had Sherrod Brown and Elizabeth Warren, part of that process, saying, here are some things we can do to help community banks. They are not exactly the kinds of people that would ramp up systemic risk. However, every time that they did this, the Republicans would say, well, we can do that, but you have to do something for big banks, too. And the talks would kind of end there. And this kind of went as a pattern for many years until the Trump election. And now there was a situation where someone in the White House would actually sign a bill that combined community bank relief with, help for larger banks. And Sherrod Brown, who's the ranking member of the banking committee, and Mike Crapo, who's the head of the bank committee, got together and they started negotiating again. And Brown cut off the talks because, again, they were asking for too much for big banks under the guise of a community bank bill, essentially using community banks as a human shield so that Wall Street banks could get more deregulation. And unfortunately, the day after Sherrod Brown walked away from these talks, four Democratic members of the banking committee walked right into Mike Crapo's office and said, let's make a deal. And obviously their support was enough in the banking committee to put it over the top. And these four Democrats are John Tester, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, and Mark Warner. Now, Mark Warner, we know, is someone who's certainly a centrist and who believes that more deregulation might be beneficial to the system. Heitkamp, Tester, and Donnelly are all up for reelection in states that Trump won by a lot. And while they have shown populism here and there in certain forms, they seem to be animated by this idea that they have to show bipartisanship somewhere in order to win re-election. Now, I would argue that showing bipartisanship, quote unquote, by deregulating banks is kind of foolish. However, the fact is that if you look at the campaign contributions, the number one, two, and three members of the Senate who are getting donations from commercial banks are Heitkamp, Tester, and Donnelly. So this is largely a pay-to-play system where lobbyists ask for this relief, and these Democrats collaborate with Republicans to give it to them.
And I have to say, like, you know, I've long since gotten over my Tester angst, but this is I mean, this guy was literally sitting on a tractor when he ran for that primary. I guess that was in 2006, maybe, I'm thinking. It must have been. And he was sitting on a tractor, and I'm sure you remember Marcus Melitzis of the Daily Kos made it his mission to get John Tester in to beat the DLC-sponsored candidate because that DLC-sponsored candidate was too corporatist. Was successful. I think he left the Tester bus over an immigration bill. This is so illustrative of a much bigger problem, in addition to it also being in and of itself a big problem in terms of legislation. But let's stay on this, on what we can learn from those four mm-hmm. people there. Because, all right, Warner if the DLC was still around, he would be a charter member.
He'd be the head of it.
But for guys like Tester, Donnelly, and Heitkamp, I imagine if you were to poll people in Montana, Indiana, and North Dakota and said, hey, do you want your senator voting to allow the big banks to basically get back into a position pre-2008 in terms of their regulations, everyone would say no. But there's nobody in those states who's gonna run against them on that, right? I mean, that's the problem.
That's right. But there's also no one in those states who's going to run against Sherrod Brown on that prospect. And Sherrod Brown is as much constrained by running for reelection in a Trump state as any of these three Democrats. And yet he doesn't see any clamoring within the state of Ohio to just dump a bunch of bank regulations. In fact, Brown is probably more likely on a raw politics level to support this bill because three of the major stadium banks that this helps, the number one provision in this bill raises the threshold for enhanced supervision of banks. In other words, more regulation on banks. It raises the threshold for mandatory regulation from $50 billion to $250 billion. This instantly exempts 25 of the 38 largest banks in the United States from enhanced regulations. And three of those banks are headquartered in the state of Ohio. Wow. Key Bank, Fifth Third Bank, and there's one other I can't think of right now. But so you know, Brown is probably more likely. None of those banks are in North Dakota or Montana or Indiana. Brown is the one feeling the heat from his local regional bankers who are saying, you got to help us out. We're not the ones that caused the crisis. And you got to give us, you know, some relief here. But he's not, he's certainly not jumping on that bandwagon. He's holding firm. It's these others who have this twisted notion that as long as they can call something that got passed bipartisan and that they were on it, that voters will somehow reward them for working together to solve the nation's problems, as if there's some problem of overregulation in the banking sector right now.
All right. So B, I want to jump back over to the side of the implications of the bill for a moment, because, yes. I mean, you know, clearly the and then we'll come back to that notion of like the desperation of these three in particular to project some type of bipartisanship, even though it's like something horrific. And what that tells us about, you know, because I think the argument would go that those three, at the least, who knows, but maybe two out of the three in a different environment would they wouldn't.
Well, I mean, just to quickly sum this up, it tells you something about Chuck Schumer and who Chuck Schumer is willing, what he's willing to go to bat for and what he's not willing to go to bat for. He kept his caucus together on tax cuts. He kept his caucus together on health care. He is not willing to put the hammer down to keep the caucus together on bank deregulation. And while he nominally says he's against the bill, he is allowing 12 Democrats and one independent that caucuses with the Democrats to defy him and defy the will of the majority of the caucus on this bill. And let it be said, if there weren't at least 9 Democrats supporting this bill, it could not pass. It could not pass the Senate. It would not pass a filibuster. Democrats are the margin of support for this bill. And Chuck Schumer is unwilling to put the hammer down and stop this bill from happening, even though he says he's against it.
Now, David, let me say, I mean, I'm so against this. I hate the idea that Citibank and these other banks would do well in this situation. I wish I could stop it. I really do. Oh, my God.
It really is a mystery why Senator Schumer would not be as persistent as he was in these other contexts.
For Chuck Schumer, this is like the gift from heaven, right? Like I can say that I was totally against it. I mean, but what am I going to
say
do?
No,
I mean,
and it can pass, and
then those guys on Wall Street,
the lobbyists know. Not they understand exactly what's going on.
They can see that Chuck is not leaving his office when it comes to this bill. He's just staying inside. Right.
Chuck Schumer was on the Senate floor this morning, the day that the test vote, the motion to proceed, is going to happen on this bill, the only bipartisan effort in this entire Congress, and he did not mention this bill once.
It slipped my mind. Come on. It slipped my mind. All right. So let's talk specifically about this bill. And one of the ways that they're doing it, and I want to get to, because you had another you had a piece out today about this bill in terms of the office of the OMB, CBO, you know, sort of scoring this bill. But before we get there, let's just talk about you mentioned a threshold. And that it expands the threshold. And so one of the ways that they're doing this, I want you to get a little more in depth on the implications of that threshold. But we should also note that one of the ways they're doing this is simply saying, like, okay, we've expanded the definition of community bank, right? Like, you know, you might think it's a small community, but community could be wherever your heart is. And that's the way we expand it.
Right. So they've expanded the threshold up to $250 billion. Now, so the context is that Countrywide, when it was issuing one out of every five mortgages in this country, was a $200 billion operation, had $200 billion in assets. So they would be exempt from all of this particular regulation, despite the fact that they failed miserably and helped trigger the financial crisis.
What is the suite of regulations, though, for people
You're
under that threshold?
You're talking about extra capital, extra liquidity requirements. In other words, holding reserves that can absorb losses. You're talking about extra supervision for risk management standards, so that more bank examiners will be in your bank, seeing that you have proper risk management controls. And it adds stress tests, so that there are tests to see whether you could survive an adverse economic scenario. So those are the main enhanced standards that we're talking about.
So it all boils down to basically like, hey, dude, you only make $3,000 a month. You can't go out and be, you know, charging $6,000 a month on your credit card, more or less, right? I mean, you can't go out and invest and speculate on things where you don't have the money to cover it.
And here's the thing about these stadium banks. These are the early warning system for our financial system. When a stadium bank like a Countrywide or National City, which was about $150 billion bank, when it failed because it was a big subprime lender during the crisis, or GMAC, which required a huge bailout during the crisis, it was about $150 billion bank. When these banks fail, the market understands that they're, you know, following a lot of the trends that the bigger banks are engaging in. And when these banks have trouble, they know that trouble is going up the chain. And so there's a very close relationship, a connection between these banks at the $100 billion and above level of assets and the mega bank. And so if you're loosening regulations on these lower banks, it has a lot of implications. Number one, it removes that market discipline on the bigger banks because they're more opaque. And now we don't have that early warning system. Number two, if you raise the threshold from 50 to 250, all those banks who are just under $50 billion in assets have huge incentives to buy up competitors, because now they don't have to worry about this bar at which they're going to be subject to stiffer regulations. So this is a bank consolidation bill in addition to everything else, because it's really going to cause that dynamic at the lower levels. And you're going to see a lot of community banks fold into these, you know, larger regional stadium bank operations. Those are some of the aspects. And then, you know, obviously, having these failures could create systemic risk. If two or three of them fail, that's equal to what a Lehman Brothers was. That's right. Equal to that kind of an event. For this reason, Barney Frank has said he wouldn't vote for this bill. Daniel Tarullo, who was running supervision during the Dodd-Frank era at the Federal Reserve, said that's too much money. Pretty much everyone.
Antonio Weiss
working.
Antonio Weiss, who was kept out of his job, I guess, at Treasury, or attempted anyways.
Treasury by
Elizabeth Warren. Has come out and said, like, this sounds like a bad idea. And we should be clear too that the promotion of the consolidation is a byproduct of this, right? Because that also exacerbates the risk, because that's
right.
Why
you have more connection between fewer banks, and this interconnection within the system is really what accelerated and drove the 2008 financial crisis, because it wasn't just that Lehman Brothers failed, but Lehman Brothers had counterparties at all the other banks, and so on and so on.
So we're not only taking the canary out of the coal mine, essentially, and leaving, I don't know, I guess an ostrich down there, but the ostrich also has the unintended side effect of banging its head on the on the rafters, making it a little less stable.
And here's where this gets even worse than the state we were in before Dodd-Frank. In theory, the Federal Reserve can say, if you're a bank with more than $100 billion, I can apply these enhanced standards to you. However, they have changed one word in the language that will make this not only impossible on these banks above $100 billion, but mega banks as well. And they've changed a word. The idea is that the Federal Reserve, before applying any kind of enhanced regulation, needs to make an assessment, a risk-based assessment, to tailor these rules to a specific bank's situation. And before this law, before S-2155, it said that the Fed may apply this tailoring. They've changed one word to make it now say shall. And that sounds like nothing to go from may to shall. However, when you make it that the Fed shall apply tailoring, now they have to go through essentially a cost-benefit analysis process on every single bank that they want to enhance the standards of regulation for. And it will create a very costly litigation situation. It will give big banks a tool to say, well, look, Federal Reserve, we don't think you did it right when you did your cost-benefit analysis to show that we needed more regulation, and we're going to take you to court for it.
Right.
And it creates a chilling effect on the Federal Reserve such that they didn't have before Dodd-Frank and before the financial crisis, so that the Fed will think twice before adding these enhanced regulations at their discretion when they see a safety and soundness problem within these banks. And that is a huge, huge deal.
And we should say that dynamic of that chilling effect in these regulations being subject to court, to suits, essentially from the lawyer is undercut a lot of the supposed intent of Dodd-Frank in the first place. I mean, so what we're fighting over at this point, what we're talking about, are the last vestiges of something that was already somewhat, at least, compromised in structure when it was proposed. I mean, this is, you know, going back to the wake of 2008, where you had in particular
Let me say one other thing about this threshold. So this gets a little bit technical, and you can get the details at my story at The Intercept, which maybe you'll link to. But when you raise that threshold from $50 billion to $250 billion for domestic banks, it is also going to raise the threshold in all likelihood, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin confirmed this in testimony, it would raise the threshold for giant foreign banks that have operations in the United States that are less than $250 billion in assets. And that includes every major foreign bank operating in the United States except for one, HSBC. So every other bank, Barclays, Deutsche Bank, Santander, all of them would be lifted from these enhanced regulatory standards. And these are some of the biggest miscreant banks who have engaged in some of the worst practices and been fined as much as any bank in the world. And we're going to lift standards on these banks. What is the rationale for these huge global operations that act like big mega banks because they are big mega banks? What is the rationale for treating them the same way that you would a tiny community bank?
And to be clear, the value of having these banks, their U.S. operations, be scrutinized is it gives us another opportunity to get a sense of what's going on out there, as it were, internationally, which gives is another, I guess, it's another canary.
Internationally?
It's another canary.
And domestically. I mean, who is Deutsche Bank? That's right. Donald Trump's personal banker, right? I mean, they have engaged in money laundering. They've engaged in tax evasion. They've engaged in transactions with sanctioned companies. And I'm not just talking about Deutsche Bank right now, but all of these global banks that would be covered under this rule. Santander engaged in illegal repossessions of cars from military members serving on active duty. I mean, these are the kinds of banks that we're lifting from enhanced regulatory standards that make no sense at all.
The CBO came out with a warning about this, I guess, today or yesterday, on Monday, I guess it was.
It was late yesterday, yeah, and I wrote a story today. And one thing I want to highlight in that, so CBO said that this bill, you know, because they talk about scoring a bill, they talk about the cost of the bill, and they said this bill will cost $600 million as an estimate, and that's not really very much money at all.
Nope.
Over a 10-year time frame. But the reason that they said it would cost money is because it would raise the possibility of a large bank failure or a financial crisis. That is the reason that they said it would cost money, because it would cost money to the FDIC's deposit insurance fund. It would cost money to unwind these large banks that would fail. It's saying it all it is saying is that this bill raises the chance of a financial crisis and the need for another bailout.
So in other words,
that is what CBO said.
That cost to the U.S. government, at least, which is, I think, sort of narrowly constructed, is a shadow of what would be cast by an event that would impact the private financial system.
That the $600 million reflects the increase in probability. It isn't a direct cost, because if we had a financial crisis, it would cost a hell of a lot more than $671 million to the U.S. government. I want to just touch on one other thing that's related to that, and that is what I've been calling the Citigroup carve-out. So this bill is supposed to be for community banks and credit unions, but what I learned is that Citigroup has been lobbying very heavily on two provisions in particular, sections 402 and 403 of the bill. And they get a little bit technical, but I'll try to explain them as best I can quickly. So one of them changes the calculation of the leverage ratio. And the leverage ratio is just a simple calculation of the equity of a bank divided by its assets. And leverage is when it goes up, you have more opportunity for higher returns, but you also increase risk, because that equity is what you would use to cover your losses if you ever got into trouble. So in the bill, the Senate wanted to give this help to what they call custodial banks, which are banks that don't make loans necessarily, but they hold other assets in custody and perform administrative work on them. There are only three really custodial banks in the country: Bank of New York Mellon, State Street, and Northern Trust. However, Citigroup performs custodial services, even though they're not a custody bank, and they saw this provision that would allow these custody banks essentially to raise their leverage, which means raise their returns, and thought, we want in on this action. This is unfair. We do custody stuff, even though it's not our main thing.
Right.
So we want to be able to raise our leverage too. And they got the Senate to change the definition of a custody bank so that Citigroup would have an opportunity to take advantage of that. And the CBO score says that we think that the two big banks who perform custodial services, which is Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase, would have a 50-50 chance of being able to take advantage of this and reduce their leverage. Now, if you think, or actually increase their leverage, reduce their leverage requirement, if you think that Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase are wildly overcapitalized and need to be unshackled to take on more risk, then that's what you're voting for in this bill. That Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase should have the opportunity to make their case that they should be able to load up on more risk in the financial system. The other piece that Citigroup has been lobbying for, which they did get, is a little more technical, but allows them to use municipal bonds to count as highly liquid assets in case they do get into trouble. They can count them under what is called the liquidity coverage ratio. And that's supposed to be a test of how many liquid assets you have if you do run into a crisis. And these are liquid assets you can sell off very quickly and easily. Muni bonds are very thinly traded. It's difficult to trade them. And the idea that they're liquid assets is very dubious. And this also sort
and
of
particularly
in.
Particularly in the instance if there is a systemic
financial crisis,
the idea that you're going to be able to sell those muni bonds. And I mean, so that people understand, and basically there's two things that are going on here. It's basically like saying, me in Vegas, and I get to the table and the casino is now basically saying, Mr. Cedar, based on no change in your income and your ability to pay, we're now going to give you some extra chips to play with. You just got to pay us back at the end of this session. And on top of that, I now said, hey, but you guys, I also got a early model Subaru. And they go, oh, well, we didn't realize that. In that case, we're going to give you an extra 25% of your chips.
Nobody's buying your Subaru.
Because you can always sell your Subaru if you get in trouble.
And not only that, it hooks the entire market for Subarus into a financial crisis event, right? It hooks the municipal bond market, which had nothing to do with the situation that might have gone on with respect to any future financial crisis. So muni bonds were not related to the 2008 crisis. But if you do this thing where a bunch of banks are going to have muni bonds and want to sell them if they get into trouble, then you've added this huge market into the event. You've connected the muni bond market to the financial system in a way that is just going to ramp up risk exponentially.
Because just to be clear, because that means that they become an asset class that are considered to be a life preserver or one of the life preservers.
A prized asset class. They're considered to be like cash. Yes.
Well,
and by the way, we have scratched the surface of what's in this bill. There are weakening of mortgage regulations. There are there's a complete removal of regulations for the manufactured home industry, which is actually a big gift to the largest manufactured home company, like a trailer park company, which is owned by Warren Buffett. There is all sorts of really bad ideas in this bill under the guise of giving relief to community banks. So this is a huge bait and switch. They're going to be voting on it today. It looks like they have the votes, but there is sort of mounting pressure on these Democrats to abandon this bill. And if they needed another reason, the fact that the CBO says this makes a financial crisis more likely might be a good one.
And again, so much of this, at least when we talk about the nine needed, and I would imagine Angus King is probably also one of these guys who wants to be able to say, like, I'm doing something bipartisan. That's why I'm here. That's why.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And
most of them, I say, would be. I mean, look, Doug Jones is on this bill. Doug Jones is supporting this bill. The hero of the resistance, Doug Jones, who has a big regional bank, Regions Bank, right in his backyard. They're one of the stadium banks. It's the home of the Birmingham Barons of the AA, Major League Baseball. And, you know, this is just another example.
Give me a sense. Is this a elections have consequences scenario? I mean, it's not like, I mean, I think there are some people on this who are ideologically like, this is why I'm in the Senate, to make sure that banks can do well here. But I mean, if there was a different makeup of the Senate, if there was a different person in the White House who would not be so willing to sign a Republican-controlled bill. Does this happen?
I think that the turnover in the White House is a major trigger for this bill. Obviously, Trump came in and said he wanted to do a number on Dodd-Frank. So there's no question this bill doesn't happen without a President Trump. I think that what ends up happening with these bills, there's a pendulum, right? We have a financial crisis. We put in a bunch of regulations to try to make the system safer. And then people's memories get shorter and shorter. And then the pendulum swings back to deregulation. And usually it takes a few years after that deregulation for another crisis to occur. And people don't normally connect that bill that happened years ago with the reason for the crisis. I mean, you saw that in the financial crisis where there were a host of bills over 30 years to change the mortgage market to allow these private banks to load up on these mortgage-backed securities and create them, that really led to the crisis. But nobody sort of blamed, Jake Garn, who was the author of Garn St. Germain in 1982, that was a primary contributor to creating the conditions for mortgage-backed securities. No one like went to his house and said, you were the reason that we had a financial crisis. But, it's certainly more plausible than anything else. So this is the pendulum, banks get into trouble. We regulate them. Everybody forgets. We deregulate them. Banks get into trouble. And that's the pendulum we're on right now.
David Dayan, I wanted to talk to you about Ohio v. American Express. It is an important Supreme Court case that involves some real antitrust implications, but we will have to do that another time.
Some other time.
All right. Well, we will. In fact, I've decided we will in fact link your intercept piece.
I lobbied hard for that.
Oh yeah, so, you did. We changed the definition of things we would give links to, and so we were able to slide you in.
Right.
Under that new provision, but David Dayan, the best
for,
place for
grandfather
folks,
and me.
This is I'm going to give like another like this is the, my insider tip of the day. If you want to know what David Dayan is up to, you head over to daviddayan.tumblr.com, where it's a clearinghouse of everything you are writing. Barely a day goes by where another piece is not up, and it is all over in the best publications across the internet. David Dayan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, buddy.
All right, thank you.
All right, and we will put a link to the Tumblr as well as the piece. We're going to do both. Mm-hmm. Special two for Tuesday, where we give two links to anybody named David Dayan who comes on to our program. Maybe we'll even do three because you could do, they both start with a T. So we could do three links. Maybe that's more of like a Thursday thing.
Let's not go too crazy.
Well, we don't want to go too crazy. But all right, folks, there you have it. And a very important story. If you have the opportunity to call one of these senators, by all means do so. I mean, if you're in Maine, call Angus King's office. If you're in Montana, in fact, Matt, maybe after the show, maybe you call Heidi Heitkamp. Indiana, call Donnelly.
Totally waterboated it, dude.
Totally waterboated it?
You don't even remember that reference.
I don't remember anything anymore.
Dude, you just waterboated it.
Did I waterboat that too? Is that a North Dakota reference?
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Is that what you do?
You don't get it. You don't get it.
Is that like when you you spilt the bong water or something like that?
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sure.
We got Angus King. Who else? I guess Doug Jones. You know, and I think you say to these people,
Gene
this
Shaheen.
Is,
in New Hampshire.
Oh, is she voting for this as well?
Yep.
These are people who want to project that they are doing something bipartisan so that they look reasonable. They're just not going to talk about the details of... They're not going to talk about a word of what David Dayan just talked about. They're going to talk about how we have helped community banks. So your local bank, Granite State Bank or
you want me to read off the list?
Yeah.
It was Bennett, who's Colorado. Carper and Coons.
That's right. They're old Rocky Mountain local bank.
Right. Carper and Coons, Delaware senators are always horrible on these things, but you should bother them anyways. Did you already mention Donnelly?
Donnelly, yeah. Heitkamp
and Tester, Jones, Kane. I think Kane is Kane a co-sponsor on it?
That's not surprising. Okay. You know, I'm not sure if you remember this. He was a vice presidential candidate for the Democratic Party.
You know, I don't remember it. That's actually my sort of main takeaway from Kane is I don't remember. Hassan, also from New Hampshire. Stabenow.
Oh, really? Eesh.
Yeah, I think that's it.
And those are all those type of places where you would imagine there is some, they want to be able to say that they are bipartisan in some fashion. In some instances, they use the bipartisan.
I collaborated with Trump to hurt people in my state in a way that actually could have been used to attack him effectively. And to reiterate, not voting for it, but Schumer complicit and facilitating of it.
What?
I also wonder what Gillibrand, I mean, she voted against it, but I wonder if
it's
not her job to whip.
In the way that Schumer does. I mean, Schumer has the all the goodies and the supposed leverage.
But repealing this would be an interesting question for her if she decides to run. You know,
yeah.
she's something I want to get very specifically about.
She's going to say, I'm against it. Of course.
Yeah.
It's a freebie.
Well, get all of them on the record.
Do you think this is this bipartisanship is like a sincere first tier electoral strategy, or is it like a justification after the fact? Like, oh, we're just trying to be bipartisan because, like, I feel like
I think with some of them it is, and some of them it's not. Like Warner, it seems to me that would be the case that he's just saying I'm being bipartisan, but this was an agenda. I would say Kane, same deal. But I think for someone like Tester, who has a record of being on sort of the other side of this.
Didn't he vote against the cram down, though, back in the Obama? I feel like Tester's very sketchy.
Yes, there's no doubt.
I might be inclined to agree a little bit more with Jamie.
I just feel like most people, if you explain to them what this is, they hate the big banks. I mean, even Trump went after the big banks
a little bit
in his campaign trail rhetoric. Who, so, like, what gives?
Who is going to make that argument running against John Tester? Not the Republican. I mean, that's the problem.
Someone in the primary.
Maybe. And if they take the time to listen to 45 minutes of David Dayen explaining the implications of this, they might be like, oh, God, this is horrible, Tester. I mean, honestly, that I think is like the dilemma. The ease in which you can just go out and say, hey, this is a vote to support my community bank. Who doesn't like their community bank?
Bipartisan collaboration to support community banks. It's not bad sales right there.
And this is the dilemma. There are certain areas where you got a guy like Sherrod Brown, who's a perfect example of that's what makes him so popular amongst people like us, right? Because even though he might have more incentive to vote for this bill, he doesn't. And that's what makes him as far as these things go, a good politician, or one that we would like. Then you have these people who sort of float in the middle. And if they see an opportunity, they'll take it. And that's what is problematic about situations like the one that we're in. It's sort of the Mike Pence rule, right? Like, that's why they can't go out to dinner with women who aren't their wives, because they're so tempted. And so they, you got to make sure they never go out to dinner with someone who's not their wives. Maybe I'm getting a little bit off far afield.
Just a little. That was good self-assessing right there.
Thank you.
12 Rules of Life. An anecdote to chaos.
Folks, this program relies on your support. Who else but you would support a program that would spend 40 minutes on Section 102 of the... Of S2155.
Especially on Sam Nunberg.
Right, on Sam Nunberg Day. Right now, you could turn to any one of our sister or brother or cousin or very distant cousin channels.
Who's laughing now, Sam?
And they are talking about Sam Nunberg, and we're talking about bank deregulation. So if you appreciate that and want the opportunity to hear more, become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com, pennies a day. If you, and as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content virtually every single day. If you are one of those people who want that extra content, but you do not have the financial means to support the program, send us an email. We're woefully behind on emails, but bear with us. We will get there. We had some technical glitches on something a while back and still sort of digging out of that. But jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Tonight is Tuesday, I believe, which is TMBS. What? TMBS night. Wait a second. The special counsel finds Kellyanne Conway violated federal law against using her office for partisan politics. Is that
I just saw that headline. It was reported in the Hill.
Yeah, the Hatch Act. I mean, I don't think anyone has ever been prosecuted under the Hatch Act. But, I mean, let's be honest, folks. You know, it's just one more thing put on the heap of stuff that is going on in that White House that is corrupting and corrosive.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
But tonight is TMBS. I'm sure it's going to be a Sam Nunberg fest.
Actually, I'm trying to think of how to fit Sam Nunberg in. Somebody requested that I do the whole show as Sam Nunberg. But the it's actually going to be a sort of overview of North Korea stuff. The history of the breakdown of that policy, then a check-in on West Virginia, and the guests are Natalie Shore, and then Nomiki Konst is going to be in studio.
That sounds great.
It's going to be great.
There you go. And Jamie has posted something on her Patreon, is the word that I'm hearing.
Oh, in 7
my,
o'clock.
Patreon circles. Is that right?
I have indeed.
And what is it on, Jamie?
It is about the West Virginia teacher strike and what we as workers can learn from it.
And certainly it's inspired Oklahomans. Apparently they're talking about a potential strike there as well.
Hell yeah.
All right, folks. Like I say, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off your coffee purchases there. Great coffee, great company. You will enjoy. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your calls and your IMs in the fun half.
C'est une poupée qui fait non. C'est une poupée qui fait non. Toute la journée, elle fait non. C'est une poupée.